We're very privileged and pleased to have with us this morning Duncan Podbury. Duncan's become a good friend of mine. He's an elder at Newcastle City Church. And as he arrived this morning, he was amazed by how many people he knew here already. That's with his involvement with FP and with the challenge just recently. So, Duncan, your first time with us, but you're welcome here. And I'd love it if we could welcome him as he comes and shares God's word with us.
Hey there, guys. How's it going? It's really nice to be here this morning. Just to introduce myself, I'm based at City Church up in Newcastle, and been in the North East since I was an 18-year-old. As an 18-year-old, my parents packed me off to do my university choices, so rather than taking the UCAS guide, I took NME, New Musical Express, to try to find out where the good gigs were, and that year they were in Tyneside, so I ended up applying to Newcastle and studied politics, came down to Durham later on for another course and stuff. So it's lovely to be with you this morning. We still live in Newcastle. I've got three wee boys. I'm married to Susanna. And I've done various things since finishing studying. So I've been a barman. I've been a chicken farmer. I was in marketing for a bit. And I taught high school history. So, you know, some people say, Duncan, your CV looks like you can't hold a job down. But I like to think that it offers a potential employer a range of diverse and transferable skills. So if anyone's interested, anyway, today I work at City Church, and it's good to be here today. I'm not much of a preacher, but I am a storyteller. So today we're going to tell some stories around this theme of what it is to ask. I've never used one of these before, but I am excited. Here we go. So we're going to look at asking. But to kick things off, I would love us to give a clap and welcome a guy who's becoming a friend of mine, James Moorcroft. We're going to hear a little bit about his story as we think about this whole thing of asking questions of God. So let's give James a round of applause so he comes up. Hey, James. Now, I've gotten to know James over perhaps the last 18 months or something. We were away for 3 days in Teesdale last month, and mate, over a beer, we were sort of telling each other our stories about finding a relationship with God, which is always an interesting thing to explore with someone. And James, you were telling me that when you pitched up in Durham as, a, I guess, an 18-year-old.
So I think I was 18.
Yeah, fresh from Manchester. How actually this whole faith thing, you know, wasn't a part of your life, but then you met a guy who invited you to church. Was he on the rowing team or something like that?
He was in the novice rowing team. I was in the senior rowing team.
Okay, we hear you, we hear you.
You sat somewhere in this room.
So you end up pitching up a church one Sunday morning. I guess it's largely unfamiliar, but that Sunday morning started you off on a journey. It started you off on your life changing. Can you tell us a little bit about that Sunday morning?
The first Sunday I came to where we used to meet in the Sixth Form Centre, and I came along with my then girlfriend, now wife, Jenny, who's out in the foyer with our wonderful daughter, Zoe. And we just came along to church, sat down, watched people worship with their hands in the air, tried not to listen to the person who was speaking, and went home. Then came back the next week, and the same thing sort of happened. And then the third week, Jenny was ill and couldn't come, so I came on my own. Yeah. Sat in a chair, and a guy stood up and spoke about something that I didn't listen to. But at the end, he said, if anyone needs to leave, then if anyone needs to be prayed for, then please don't leave. And so I thought, okay, fair enough, there must be people that need praying for. So I put my coat on. It was kind of winter. It's always winter, isn't it?
Yeah, in the North East, yeah.
And put this big long coat on and went to the exit and thought, I don't need this. I'll just go, and got to the exit, steps that led down to the doors that you walked out of, and at the top of the steps, my feet stuck firm to the floor.
So you had this very odd physical experience.
I studied philosophy at Durham, and this doesn't happen to someone who's, you know, a rationalist, who thinks about things that, well, I can understand everything, that's what I thought, that my world view is that anything that happens, I can codify and understand by my understanding. This, I couldn't understand.
This was out of the box. So, you've got...
As a box.
So, you end up thinking, okay, I'll give this a go. I will go and chat to this guy and get prayed for. And then later on in the week, you're in a philosophy seminar with other students and your lecturers and so on. And the subject of that week was what?
The subject of that week was the varieties of religious experience. And we were studying a book by a philosopher called William James. And, oh, by the way, on that Sunday morning, a guy had stood up and he'd said two things to me, which he'd said were from God, but they were dead on, spot on. And I thought, how could he have known that? And I was freaked out.
Okay, so there's a couple of things going on.
And so I sat in this tutorial in the library in the philosophy department, and it's all very austere, and everyone's being very serious whilst they're telling jokes. And then this guy starts off the tutorial and says, has anyone here, in a very jokey voice, anyone here ever had a religious experience?
And the response was from the group?
It's a uniform no, apart from me, I stuck my hand up in the air. And everyone looked at me and thought I was joking, but then I started to explain what had happened.
It's amazing. So the weeks go by and you come to a place of deciding to follow Jesus. Give us one thing that helped you get to that point of deciding this is a real thing, I probably need to give my life to this.
The guy who spoke on that morning and prayed for me is a really good friend of mine now. And he said, do you want to meet up and talk about it? And, you know, talk the things through. I went to church as a kid. I played in the music group at the church. And he said, do you want to meet up and talk about the things that you know up here, but you don't know the connection between here and here? And I said, yeah, we'll meet up and we'll talk. And the things, there was an empty vacuum in my heart. Whilst being at university, I don't really see the point. I guess it was a bit of an existentialist.
Yeah.
For those of you, if you don't know what that means, it means you sit in a coffee house and drink black coffee and despair about life. And so I met up with him, and it wasn't that the vacuum was filled. It was I began to understand that this man, Jesus Christ, didn't offer just to fill a hole. He offered to transform me and make me into a new person.
That's and so I jokes. Thought,
that's a good deal. And, you know, it answers all the questions. But beyond that, it answers the yearning, which was within me.
Mm.
And it answered questions about identity, about who I was, about how I could sustain myself, which I realized that I couldn't. And so that, you know, through talking these things through with a guy who was very caring, honest, thoughtful, and just a generally good egg.
That was a turning point.
Yeah, that was it.
It's fantastic, James. Well, look, we love seeing what God's doing in your life. Let's give James a clap. Thank you so much, James. Cheers, mate. Now, James's story is so helpful because one of the things which it features strongly is this idea of questions that need both asking and exploring and perhaps even facing up to. And that's the thing which we want us to look at today. We're going to look at this question of what is it to ask? What would that look like spiritually? What would it look like in conjunction with this whole God thing, this Christianity thing? Now, let me just get you to reflect for a second. What is the biggest question you've ever asked? It's a funny thought, isn't it? What's the biggest question you've ever asked? Or what about this? What's the biggest question that's ever been asked of you? Now, I reckon for most of us, it's probably either in the department of relationships or career or perhaps cash. You know, something wrong around one of those three areas. Now, for my friend Ken, his biggest question was going to become this. Will you marry me? And Ken was going out with a Scottish girl called Fiona, good-looking, intelligent. We couldn't quite understand how Ken had managed to pull it off. And after about 12 months, Ken decided, you know, this is a good thing, and I would be a fool to lose it. Now, Fee was training to be a teacher, and Ken realized what he needed a brilliant plan if he was to secure her hand in marriage. And being a teacher, she was a creature of habits. She gets up at the same time, has to be at the same place at the same time, does the same drive to work every day. And Ken had this mastered. He knew what Fiona's commute was like. And so he decided, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to think of a really creative way to propose. She'll love it, etc., etc. She won't be able to resist it. She'll say, what a romantic you are, Ken. And so at 7:30 one Wednesday morning, Ken and his friend Stevie set off in their battered old Ford Escort with a bunch of massive placards, a set of ladders, some hammers and some nails. And they went to the road in Newcastle, the A167, which Fiona drove down every day on her way to school. So they've got the signs, and Stevie's footing the ladder, Ken's up the ladder, and he's nailing the signs up, and he's thinking, this is brilliant, come 8 o'clock, Fiona's going to drive down here, and her life is going to change forever because of the question that I'm about to ask her. And you know, what Ken didn't realise was the school was about to be Ofsted-ed. That didn't make any sense to his non-teacher mind. And so Fiona, as a conscientious member of staff, is up early, she's in the car, and she's away. And she's driving down the A167 when she sees two familiar figures up a tree in the twilight, because it's the autumn, with hammers and nails and some badly painted signs. And they've got some, but not all, of the signs up. And she's driving along, she's thinking, what are those guys doing? Oh my goodness, I know those guys! Oh my word, it's my boyfriend Ken. And so she stops the car, she gets out the door, and she walks to the ladders, and she sort of pushes Stevie out of the way. And she says, Ken, what on earth are you doing? And Ken turns round with the final sign. She's looked at Fiona, will you? And he switches the sign round. He says, what do you think? Holding the marry me bit. It was the biggest question he'd ever asked. I'll tell you what she did, this is a killer. She said, I don't know. And anyway, I've got to go to work. You know, imagine that. What a thing. You know, questions are a big deal in my house. I have three small ginger boys, okay? So breakfast at our house is like breakfast at the Weasley's house. And my middle boy, Barney, is like this fella off Outnumbered. Are you familiar with Outnumbered? This is Ben. This guy asks a whole stack of questions. He is unremitting. And that's what my Barnaby's like. He just goes and goes and goes with the questions. And it's everything, you know, it's about football, it's about God, it's about stuff like Dad. Why can't I put my fingers in the sockets? I'm like, Barney, don't do that! Please take the fork away from the socket. Why? Because you will have an injury. Why? Because electricity is running at 230 volts. Blah, 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 blah. Why? And you can see him looking at me kind of going, you've got 2 degrees, and is that the best you can do? When I started teaching high school, I found out that the whole questions thing is so important. It's how we learn, and it's how we make sense of the world. Now, that's hard, because sometimes the questions which come your way aren't scripted, but they're important. And actually, oftentimes, a question would come my way which would reveal the holes in my own thinking. Now, there's three things you can do when a big question like that comes your way, I've discovered. The first is to do a bit of power play. A question comes your way, and I was a history teacher, and I don't know what the answer is. And so, instead, you go for aggression and embarrassment and stuff, and you say, what do you mean you don't know that? Come on, you've only got 4 years till you finish high school and you don't know that? The other thing that you can do is that you can put it back on the kids. You can say, well, do you know what? That's a great, let's do that for homework this week. Or alternatively, you can stall. Okay, and stalling was the big one for me. You can say, what a fantastic question. Do you know, no one has ever asked that very important question in this classroom here. So guys, what do we think? Now that's a genius strategy with a hard question. Getting married, I wondered if that would work in my marriage. And it turns out it's a rubbish strategy. So when Susanna says to me, Duncan, why haven't you fixed the toilet yet? The response, what an excellent question. I haven't heard that before. Why don't we explore that together and share our findings when we meet again next week? Doesn't go down well. But a question can open up all sorts of things for us. You know, about 500 years ago, a guy called Copernicus, who was the nephew of a bishop, he trained in medicine and in astronomy, was starting to ask some questions of his own. You see, the dominant idea of the day was this, that the center of the solar system was the universe, because the universe, was the Earth, because the Earth was the most important thing to God. And around the Earth orbited the planets and the sun and all that sort of stuff. And Copernicus did some thinking, and he started to ask some questions. And the thing was this, that asking those questions meant that he had to break from the pack. He had to break from the pack of his family, which thought that to ask any sort of question like that would be disrespectful to God. He had to break from the pack of the academic world, the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times, and asked something that was outside the box. It was unfamiliar. It was challenging the orthodoxy. And he would face both ridicule and exclusion if he started to publicly ask that question. And yet in being willing to both ask it and listen to the evidence of the possible answers. Copernicus began to see things in a totally new way, and of course changed the course of modern science in a massive way. There are some obstacles which we need to overcome if we're going to ask some questions, if we're going to find meaning in this life. Obstacles within ourselves and obstacles around us. Are you willing to do that? Now, asking a question is a hard thing. It can make you feel nervous because it suggests that actually we don't have it all nailed down. James did so well as a philosophy student whose views were suddenly challenged by his experience of meeting some new people to actually lift the lid on that box of faith and begin to look at it again. That required bravery and breaking from the pack. But the really interesting thing is this, that there's something about Jesus which people saw in him, which meant they knew they could ask him their questions. They knew that they could come to him with questions like, Jesus, what is the most important thing in following God? Jesus, who are you? Jesus, where's the proof that you are who you say you are? You know, questions like that, some of which are offensive. But actually, they saw something in Jesus, which meant that they could ask the thing that was inside their heart. And by asking it, perhaps unlock a whole different sort of existence. Jesus not only welcomed people's questions, but he also asked a lot of questions back. So he asked questions like this, who do people say I am? And then more direct questions like this, what about you? Who do you say I am? Now, one of the many folk that felt compelled to take their questions to Jesus and also felt able to ask a big question of Jesus is a guy called Nicodemus. And why don't we have a look in the Bible? This is worth doing because at this point we start to get some first-hand observations of what Jesus is like. That's going to help us if we're looking to find out more about whether God's at work in this Jesus thing. This is what one observer recorded of one conversation between a guy called Nicodemus and Jesus. And it starts like this. Now there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a member of the Jewish ruling council. He came to Jesus at night and said, Rabbi, which meant, you know, teacher, we know you're a teacher who's come from God, for no one could perform the miraculous signs you were doing if God were not with him. So here's Nicodemus. Now let's just think about this for a second. Who is this guy? Okay, he's a religious and civic figure. He's part of the elite there in Jerusalem, an important city. Some people say not only was he a religious leader and a civic leader, he was also a benefactor. So here's a guy with some profile who's right at the centre of national religious life and is very orthodox within that. And yet actually, inside his heart, there's a question which if he asks it means he's going to make himself very, very vulnerable. Seeking an answer to this question might challenge all of the assumptions that Nicodemus has based his life on. It might mean that actually he has to stand back from the people who his whole life has gravitated around and say, actually, that thing that I believed, I know this isn't going to be popular, guys, but I'm not sure it's the case. I'm not sure our rejection of this Jesus thing was right. So him coming to Jesus with his question, man, this is radical. This guy's gutsy. What's going to happen? So he comes to Jesus at night. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because I wonder if he's coming to Jesus at night because although he's ready to ask the question, he's not quite ready to risk the exposure of being seen to be engaging with Jesus and asking those questions. Now that could be a little bit insulting for Jesus. But actually we see that Jesus makes space for Nicodemus and begins to engage with him. Now, Jesus isn't offended, and in asking this question, Nicodemus is making himself really vulnerable. He's making himself vulnerable socially in terms of what the reaction of the community might be, and he's making himself vulnerably internally. At this point in time, he's going to allow the way he's seen the world to be challenged and tested. Now, have you ever done that? Have you ever done that? It takes a brave person to do that. Now, vulnerability is a really important thing, and when we get to this place of vulnerability, actually, we're on the cusp, perhaps, of finding some clarity, and we're definitely on the threshold of moving into a challenging place. I work for a city church in Newcastle at the moment, one of the pastors there. And after Christmas, we had what has become known in my family as Christmas tree gates, when a major storm blew up in our staff. And I organise a Christmas campaign at City Church every year. I totally love it. We get in a tree that's about 26 foot high. Now, how cool is that? That's a big tree. And check this out. To get it out, we have to chainsaw in the church meeting room. Isn't that cool? Indoor chainsawing. So I have a whole lot of fun around Christmas time. But actually, the way I manage the Christmas campaign this year, which is a big thing, it involves all the staff, blah, 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 left some people feeling disrespected and used. I totally didn't realise it. But my secretary, Katie, went to our church leader, Ian, and said, Ian, I need to tell you some stuff about Duncan, about how he works, because actually we're hitting the point of having had enough. Now, when Ian came to me with this thing of a challenge that was going to change the way I saw myself and how I operate and stuff, I was gutted, because I love our staff team and I care about our church and I care about Katie. She makes enormous sacrifices for the things we do, and I couldn't believe that I'd treated them like this. I just hadn't seen it, and I realised out of that I had to ask some questions. And if I was going to have the guts to ask these questions, it would mean making myself vulnerable, making myself weak, both internally and socially. So I embarked on a period of a few weeks of going around and talking to each of the staff and doing it with one of the trustees so they felt safe and all that sort of stuff, and asking them this question: how do I come across to you? I realise, of course, some pain for some of our team. Some of our team feel disrespected by my working practices. Would you tell me what your experience has been like? And doing that makes you feel vulnerable. You're exposing weakness. You're opening yourselves up to actually being honest about the reality of who you are. But the thing is this, that if you can get over that short-term pain, the long-term might be very different. It might be very fruitful. And this is the pill that Nicodemus has got to decide whether or not he's going to swallow. And we're going to ask this question about whether I've got the right view of Jesus or not. Swallowing this pill might cause some short-term pain. It might mean that I've got to re-engineer and reorientate my life. But what would the long-term outcome be? And so he asks Jesus this really simple question. And it's, the Jews at the time, they're not people who talk in a very direct way, so often they'll use parables and stuff like that. It's a different culture. So this statement here is really interesting. Jesus, we know you're from God, because no one could do the stuff you're doing if they weren't from God. Nicodemus is actually saying, Jesus, I can see something in you. I can't make sense of it. What is the crack? I'm coming to you at night because I need to have this conversation with you. I'm worried about having it publicly because it'll expose me. Other people don't think like this. And how is Jesus going to react? Now, asking a question like this is dangerous. For Copernicus, asking a question which challenged how he had seen the world, how the sort of culture of the day saw the world was dangerous. It might involve change if the answer comes back in an unfamiliar way. But asking a question isn't enough. You see, God's calling us to do something more than just go on a fact-finding exercise. And for many of us, that's where it stops, with getting some information together. For Nicodemus, if he goes away with some facts, he will have missed out on the heart of what Jesus has for him. One of my friends is a guy called David, and as a teenager, David was really, really intelligent, slightly nerdy, but just an amazing guy. Like, he was one of those guys that just had facts pouring out of his brain the whole time. He had the inside track on everything. You know, it was just like Wikipedia on legs. That is David. And but he was also slightly socially awkward. And then when he was 16, someone twigged, this guy's got Asperger's. And if you've come across people with Asperger's, you'll know that these are folk who often struggle to figure out how to sort of handle social situations. So they don't deal very well with cues like body language and things like innuendo or subtleties like sarcasm and stuff like that. Life is very black and white, and it can get really confusing. And it was really helpful for David to get that diagnosis. And from then on, he had to have some support over the next few years in learning how to interact socially. And he did amazingly well. He looked for help. He received help. So anyway, David pitched up at Newcastle, started a university, and got stuck into our community in Newcastle. Lovely bloke. Bit awkward to have at a dinner party. And then one day, One day he met Ellie. Beautiful Ellie from Hull, with long black hair and a keen sense of humour. And so David did what he does best, which is the whole Wikipedia thing. And so for the next 6 months, he got the data. He asked loads and loads of questions, you know. So you know, what's your favourite, you know, book? And what's the best film you've ever been to see? Have you been travelling? Where did you go to travelling? Did you go and see that thing there? Have you ever heard about the history of dot, 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 dot? Because I know, because I'm Wikipedia on legs, etc., etc. And he struggled with trying to understand, you know, the subtleties of the female form, which is hard anyway if you're a guy, and almost impossible if you've got Asperger's. Then after a few months, he hit a point where some of his friends had to challenge him. And they had to ask David a bigger question, a really simple question, and it was this. Oh, wow. It's a question, David, do you want the facts, or do you want the person? Do you want the facts? Or do you want the person? So it's meant to be an image there of some guys having coffee in a sort of romantic way. You can imagine the scene. And this is the question which is going to come Nicodemus' way as well. What's he want? Do you want an answer to this conundrum of there's some stuff going on in your life, Jesus, which suggests that you might somehow be divine? Can you explain that? Is that all Nicodemus wants? Or is he going to take the person as well? Is he going to take the person? Now, David did so well and came up with a highly intricate plan of proposal. And the guy landed it as well, and they're now happily married and doing so well. But what about Jesus and Nicodemus? Let's see how it unfolded. So, oh gosh. here's how Jesus responds. And the interesting thing is this, that Jesus moves things on a little bit. And rather than unpacking the thing which Nicodemus puts on the table, he says this. I tell you the truth, no one can see the kingdom of God unless they're born again. Now these are offensive words for Nicodemus. Nicodemus comes back to Jesus, look, how can someone be born when they're old? You know, look at me, I'm middle-aged or whatever. How's that going to happen? He can't go back into his mother's womb. Jesus comes back to Nicodemus and says, look, I tell you the truth, no one can enter God's kingdom. No one can enter God's kingdom unless he's born of water, and that's a religious thing. They were doing baptism and stuff like that. And the Spirit, God's Spirit. Nicodemus, flesh gives birth to flesh, but the Spirit, God's Spirit, is the only thing that can make you spiritually alive. Now, asking questions is dangerous. See, asking questions, if you're going to be willing to receive the answer, might mean that you have to change. That's the reality. Now, when I was teaching, one of my best friends was a guy called Martin who studied Nietzsche in Germany. And it left Martin in a very hardened place. And actually, Martin hated Christians. And I had a funny experience when I turned up at the school. I was just praying, and I felt like the Lord just said to me, just don't tell folk you're a Christian straight away. I'm quite a gobby person, so I had to rein in my natural instincts. But, okay, Lord, that's a bit weird, but I'll run with it. And so for a couple of months I got to know Martin, and we became really good mates, and it was obvious that he hated religion, and he hated gods, and he hated Christians. Really what he did was he hated the idea of it all. And then after a couple of months, we became good buddies. He realized that I was a Christian. And it really, really threw him. Because he was like, oh, we get along, and you're a Christian. Worse than that, you're really involved in the church, like you're serious about it, etc., etc. And it began to unsettle his worldview. And so he spent the next 2 or 3 years talking about faith and God and all that sort of stuff. One of the things which happened was, around about that time, Tony Blair was starting to explain some of the reasons he'd gone to war in Iraq. And one of the things which came out in the news one day was this statement, that he felt that God had led him to make that decision. And I remember Martin coming into the staff room, I think it was a Thursday morning, with the Guardian, and slamming it down on the paper, on the table, and going, see, that proves this God thing is a load of rubbish, Duncan. And very, very strong opinion, you know, I could appreciate the anger in it, etc., etc. I said, no, Martin, it doesn't. The only thing that tells us is it tells us something about Tony Blair. It doesn't tell us anything about God. See, for a lot of us, we've got a view of how we want things to be. And the question is, are we actually going to be big enough to allow the truth to challenge that? Are we going to be brave enough to explore what the reality might be outside our worldview? You know, it might be that your worldview is right. It might be. I'm totally open to that. You know, I always think the truth can take a good kicking. So let's ask some questions. Let's ask some questions of Christianity. Let's ask some questions of the new atheists. But let's be honest about whether or not we want the answers. Let's be honest about whether we want facts or whether we're open to the person. Now, this is what Richard Dawkins said a few years ago. And he was asked, just after the publication of The God Delusion, about his own view on the reality of God. And he's been very, very aggressive to people of faith. But he said this in The Guardian in August 2008. If evidence were found for a supreme being, I would change my mind instantly. With wounded pride and great surprise, would I find it comforting? Well, what matters is what is true. And we discover truth by evidence, not by what we would like. Now, for Nicodemus, it probably would have been easier and more convenient and more comfortable for Jesus to come back to him and say, the miracles are great, aren't they, Nicodemus? But Jesus comes back to him with something bigger than that, which is to say this: look, Nicodemus, you have physical life, and you've been given it by your natural mother and father. What a wonderful thing. But for spiritual life, you're going to need God to do something. And in those moments, Nicodemus begins to see, oh my goodness, my worldview, the worldview of my community, actually isn't broad enough to accommodate the truth of who this Jesus is. Now, as this interaction closes, we don't know what happens to Nicodemus. The curtain's sort of drawn on it, and we just find out about what Jesus does the next week and where he goes next. What we find as we follow the story of Jesus on a couple of years is that sometime later, there's a conversation that goes on in the capital at this religious council, which Nicodemus is part of. And to everyone's surprise, he stands up. And when people are plotting for Jesus' execution, he stands up and he says some things which suggest he's looking for Jesus to have a fair hearing. And at that point, we start to see this: oh my goodness, Nicodemus is willing to break from the pack. You know, the weeks and the months go by and Jesus ends up being executed. And at the end of the gospel stories, the eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life, there's this very, very discreet comment in John chapter 19, where it describes how on Good Friday, when Jesus is crucified and it hits the end of the day, the Sabbath's about to start, so everybody leaves the site of the crucifixion and heads home to get ready for Passover meal and all that sort of stuff. A couple of guys pitch up. One of them's a bloke called Joseph of Arimathea, another guy who's significant in the city. The other is Nicodemus. And together, in front of the Roman centurions, they take the body of Jesus down. They take it away to a new grave. And they embalm it with 75 pounds of perfume and aloes and stuff like that. And at that moment, we see that actually, Nicodemus has not only heard the truth, he's not only found the facts, he's giving himself to the person. He's lining himself up in a way which says, actually, I'm willing to buy into this. I'm willing to invest in this. I'm going to break from the pack at this point. Because here, with all the unanswered questions that go with it, with some of the confusion and some of the chaos that's going to follow from this decision, is the truth, not in a book, but in a man. Now I wonder, how does your story finish? How do you progress from asking a question which perhaps starts, like James's, with, this is a bit odd. It doesn't add up. There's something in this equation that I don't understand, but perhaps I've got to give myself to unpacking a little bit. How do you move on from being like Nicodemus and actually taking the time, making the space to just sit back and reflect on this Jesus thing, which, yeah, actually, there are some unanswered questions here, but also there are some fingerprints on this which could point to something divine, something eternal, something of God. Are you going to be a person that engages with that? In 1991, I went to a bank holiday rock festival. I'd just finished my exams and had a very simple agenda for that weekend, which was that we would go and get hammered and snog lots of girls. And during that August bank holiday weekend, we had a great time. We saw some big bands. And we met folk from all over the UK, like happened. One of the people I met was a person who, it turned out, was a follower of Jesus. They weren't just someone who agreed with the idea, but it made a difference in their day-to-day life. A girl my age, about 16 or 17 years old at the time. And I was so struck by this. And it made sense. It rang a bell. I couldn't answer a question about evolution or suffering or anything like that, but I could just see there was some spiritual life in her. And also it made sense of a question I've been asking, that if God is real, whatever that looks like, perhaps that should have a bearing on my life. And so on the Saturday night, when my mates were dancing to the Boomtown Rats, I don't know if anyone remembers of them. It was like their swan song, to be honest. I went and stood in a field in Northamptonshire and said, God, if you're real, you can have my life. And I made the journey from finding out some facts to following and giving myself to the person of Jesus Christ. How is your story going to end? Are you even going to start on this spiritual story? Today we're asking you to do something brave. We're asking you to start asking. Now, in a second we'll close this up. Let me finish with a couple of applications. Okay, number one, for the church. So guys, if you're part of this church, what's this church going to look like? Is it going to be a place where people can come at night because they're embarrassed and feel fearful and stuff like that, and they can lay out the reality of where they're at, even though some of it is offensive? But they can do that and start to begin to connect to Jesus. That'd be a great place. What a wonderful place to build. What a wonderful place to live in. Are you going to be a place like that, not just for the seeker, but for the believer? Number two. Okay, perhaps you're asking some questions. Okay, right, are you going to ask this question of Jesus? And this is the nub here. You know, when Ellie pitched up in Newcastle and Dave spotted her across a crowded room, he totally did his research. He found out who else knew her, what her name was, all that sort of stuff. But at some point he had to engage with the person. And at some point he had to decide whether he was going to commit to and connect to that person. So if you're someone who's asking questions, you're going to start on that journey. I'm not asking you to make a proposal to God today, but are you going to start on that journey? And then there's probably some of us that are a bit like Nicodemus. Actually, we've already gone through a process of thought. And now's the time to start speaking up and saying, yeah, okay, I best come clean. Me too. I'm breaking from the pack at this point. Those would all be cool scenarios. They would all be the sort of scenarios which echo this journey which Nicodemus went on and brought life, not just facts, into his family. It brought God, not just information, into his home. Well, why don't we just pray to finish? That would be a really cool thing. And I'm going to pray. You don't have to do anything. But maybe it's time to start asking these questions of God. And you can do that silently in your own head and heart. Lord, Heavenly Father, I'm encouraged by this encounter here of a guy who has questions and has fears and doesn't get blown out of the water by your son. I'm encouraged by this story, the fact that Jesus, the Son of God, loves him enough, not just to answer his question, but challenge him, call him for something bigger, call him to receive spiritual life from God. God, do that in us, we pray. God, help us to be gutsy enough to receive an answer which might be challenging but could be life-changing as well. And to do more than collect facts, God. Father, we pray for us as a church community. We want to echo Jesus. We want to be like Jesus. We want to be generous enough to accommodate stuff that's challenging and let the truth be winnowed out in a community of love. So Lord, do that in us. Strengthen that in us, Lord. Thank you for the seeds of that, Lord. And God, for those of us who are a bit further on, we're like Nicodemus. Actually, we've heard Jesus speak to us in some shape or form. God, we want to stand up and say, you know what? I'm breaking from the pack. Me too. Now, if that's you, I dare you, come and talk to me at the end of this meeting. Now, don't look for a sign. Don't say if Duncan goes and gets a cup of tea with a girl in a red T-shirt, then that's a sign from God that I'm going to do that. Forget that. I'm going to be around for a while. My wife's got gammon in the oven, so I'm not going to hang on that long. You need to have the guts to come and talk to me, and we can help you take the next step. And it's a good next step. It's a life-changing one.